You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 1st, 2024. I'm Tyler Schroeder from Drake University. Here is our first story. Legislators Running Out of Time to Aid Victims by Tom Barton. Bill Vall fondly remembers growing up along Dubuque's bluffs. A love of the outdoors led him to join local Boy Scout Troop 23 of the Northeast Iowa Council in 1964 at the age of 11. Scouting provided opportunities for socializing and outdoor adventures, and Vall excelled taking on leadership roles. An assistant scoutmaster, Kenny Krakow, took a liking to him and some of the other boys in the troop. Vall said Krakow would take him and a couple of the other boys on outings outside the normal scouting scheduled, on camping trips, canoe trips, to air shows, and drag car and stock car races. He said Krakow often would offer to give him a ride home after scout meetings. Krakow would talk about girls, cars, Playboy magazine, and masturbation, like he was a teenager, Vall recalled. He would always make it very light and fun or entertaining, he said. We would park in front of my house and we would talk more. Krakow eventually gained Vall's trust enough to persuade him to visit his house to look at magazines with nude women and to race on the slot car track in his attic. Vall said he was drawn in by Krakow's charm and generosity, but now recognizes the inappropriate nature of his actions. He said Krakow sexually abused him more than a dozen times from when he was about age 12 until he was 15. Vall said he never was able to tell his parents or anyone else what happened. Quote, "Of course, at the time, I was unaware I was being groomed," said the 71-year-old who now lives in Tucson, Arizona. "All these activities were designed to make me feel greatly indebted to him. I had a bad relationship with my own father, so I loved the attention, and we had a lot of fun." Scout leader named on perversion files. Vall said the alleged abuse went unreported until someone eventually turned in the assistant scoutmaster, whose name was included in more than 20,000 pages of internal Boy Scout of America's documents dubbed the perversion files. And there is an image of an older man, 71-year-old Vall, and it says, "Bill Vall of Tucson, Arizona stands on Dubuque's Eagle Park several years ago. Vall says he was abused in the Boy Scouts while growing up in Dubuque. He's pushing state lawmakers to lift Iowa's statute of limitations for filing childhood sex abuse claims related to the Boy Scouts of America bankruptcy and nationwide settlement." The perversion files detailed alleged sexual abuse by scout leaders. The files detail cases from 1959 to 1985. The records were used in a landmark 2010 court case over the abuse of six boys in a troop in Portland, Oregon, and were made public in 2012. In a letter sent to the National Boy Scout Organization in December 1970, a scout executive from the Northeast Iowa Council notified the Boy Scouts of America that Krakow, then 49, had resigned due to many years of homosexual activities with boys in the area. "This fact he admitted freely to me in a conference. We have taken appropriate action here," wrote Scout Executive Max Burgoyne in a letter included in the released files. Krakow had been a volunteer with the troop since 1938 and had served as scoutmaster previously. He died in 1980. Silent for most of his 71 years, Vall is in the final stages of submitting a package of documents to the Boy Scouts of America as part of a $2.7 billion plan to give the organization a pathway out of bankruptcy while compensating tens and thousands of sex abuse victims. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement approved in court in 2022 that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who said they were abused as children by troop leaders that fund the largest of its kind in U.S. history to settle sexual abuse claims, distributing payments last fall to victims. But unless Iowa state legislators take action this year to change Iowa law, the estimated roughly 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they would be entitled to. Iowa officials in 2021 lifted the state's statute of limitations for bringing criminal charges in sexual abuse, incest, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking cases, but the law does not cover civil claims. And there's an image that says Bill Val in his Boy Scout uniform in his mid-teens, and it's a picture of a boy looking to be about 13 to 14 years old in a scout uniform sitting on the steps of some stairs. Clock ticking to change Iowa law. State lawmakers face a looming deadline to lift Iowa's civil statute of limitations for filing sex abuse claims related to the Boy Scouts bankruptcy and settlement. Iowa has 1 year from the effective date of the settlement trust, that's until Friday, April 19th, to change the law for Iowa survivors, or Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country. When figuring victims' compensation, the settlement uses a mix that weighs a variety of factors, including type of abuse, how long it lasted, the effect it had, whether the alleged abuser had other victims, whether the victim previously knew their alleged abuser, and different states' civil statute of limitations. Iowa's statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult, that their injuries and suffering are related to their alleged abuse. Gillian Dumas is an Oregon attorney who is appealing the national settlement agreement and represents an Iowan who has filed claim in the bankruptcy. Dumas said Iowa's short statute of limitations for filing lawsuits related to child sexual abuse is a significant challenge for survivors seeking justice, as they may not be able to file until they connect their abuse to adult problems. Data from the U.S. Department of Justice suggests that 86% of child sexual abuse goes unreported altogether. When victims do report, a high percentage of them delay disclosure well into adulthood. Quote, so in Iowa, because of the statute of limitations, the value of the claim is reduced by up to 70%, Dumas said. So you know that a $600,000 claim would be worth only $180,000 simply because it happened in Iowa, end quote. Victims could get pennies on the dollar. Because his alleged abuse took place in Iowa, Val estimates, due to how current state law figures into the settlement formula, he will receive between 30% and 40% of what he initially was entitled to as a claimant. Val, an engineer, estimates over his lifetime he lost a couple million dollars in wages due to crippling health issues he's coped with his entire adult life. And even then, people might only be paid 5% to 10% of the value because there's not enough money in the settlement fund, Dumas said. The reason that I oppose the plan and the other survivors oppose the plan is because it simply does not put enough money into the pot to pay them what they would if they were allowed to go forward with their own cases in state court litigation, she said. The ultimate amount paid to claimants will be determined in part by how many claims are filed and allowed, according to the Scouting Settlement Trust. Quote, until the trust knows the total number of allowed claims, it cannot determine how much can be distributed to individual claimants, end quote, a news release states. The trustee overseeing the Boy Scouts set a May 31st deadline for all remaining claims and supporting documentation to be filed. Spokespeople of the Boy Scout for the Boy Scouts of America contacted last week did not answer questions about the settlement agreement or the exact number of perpetrators and victims identified in Iowa in the bankruptcy case. Carl Bobis, CEO of the Boy Scouts of America Northeast Iowa Council, said the organization has implemented a number of protocols meant to better vet individuals put in leadership positions. Quote, we have an extremely rigorous vetting process, Bobis said in a statement to the Gazette. So, end quote. Some of the new protocols called barriers to abuse include one-on-one contact between scouts and adults and require a minimum of two trained leaders at every scouting function. Quote, we take the safety of the youth extremely seriously, and I applaud our national officers for entering into this settlement and doing things right by the victims. End quote. Bobis said, quote, we believe them and feel their pain for their suffering, end quote. The Northeast Iowa Council include Almakey, Clayton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties in Iowa, and Joe Davies County in Illinois. A lifetime of health troubles. Val said he lived in an almost normal life, but then his health deteriorated. He began experiencing crushing failure and muscle and joint pain that lasted decades and made it difficult to walk or stand. He said he developed headaches and was exhausted. Most days, he felt like he had the flu. He worked only 2 to 3 hours a day after stopping full-time work in 1995, resulting in significant lost earning potential. Beginning in 2008, Val said his energy slowly began to return after he built up his strength with regular walks. Quote, I remember sitting at my desk at work thinking I felt like I had a 50-pound backpack on my back, end quote. He said, quote, and this was not occasional. This is what it felt like every day, end quote. He said he would sleep 10 hours a night and wake up and feel like he had only slept an hour or not at all. Quote, I did live on the edge of suicide for decades, end quote, Val said. He went to many different doctors, including at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. None could figure out the origins of his illness. The Mayo Clinic told him to stay in bed and rest for 2 years. In 2023, a psychiatrist told Val that childhood abuse might be the root cause of his health issues and diagnosed him with somatoform disorder. According to the psychiatrist's report, which Val provided to the Gazette, quote, in people with somatoform disorders, the cause is thought to be intolerable psychological conflicts that are displaced into physical complaints, end quote. The report states, quote, for some people, trying to wrestle with physical symptoms is a much safer way to address these psychological conflicts than trying to directly confront the conflicts, end quote. Bill to lift limit blocked. Senator Janet Peterson, a Des Moines Democrat, again this year introduced a bill that would have eliminated the status of limitation to file civil claims for sex abuse, sex trafficking, and sexual exploitation. The legislation would create a revival window for survivors to file claims and receive 100% of damages. Senate File 2233, however, never received a subcommittee hearing and failed to clear a legislative deadline in order to remain eligible for consideration this year. The bill is supported by the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the Iowa Trial Lawyers Association, and the League of Women Voters of Iowa. Peterson said lifting the law would allow more people to come forward and report abuse while also holding organizations accountable. Opponents expressed concerns that getting rid of the statute could make it difficult for organizations to defend themselves against decades-old cases. Brad Epperle is a lobbyist who represents Iowa's Defense Counsel Association, the only organization registered against SF-2233. Epperle said the association's opposition is not related to the Boy Scouts of America case. He said a group does not oppose eliminating the statute of limitations for perpetrators, but does oppose eliminating it for organizations and employees. Quote, "If the statute of limitations was completely removed, it would be virtually impossible in some cases to defend a claim for third-party liability brought decades after the alleged occurrence," end quote. Epperle said. Dumas, the Oregon lawyer, counters that both sides bear the same burden and the victims should not be denied their right to pursue justice. Quote, "States like Iowa should do everything they can to help those abused in Iowa get whatever justice they can get," end quote. She said, quote, not tip the scales in favor of any individual or organization that facilitated or allowed child sexual abuse on their watch," end quote. A last-minute push. States including Alabama recently have passed laws lifting their statute of limitations for civil claims on sexual abuse to allow those abused in the Boy Scouts of America to file claims with the Scouting Settlement Trust. Quote, "It's really painful," Peterson said, of frustration with lawmakers' inaction to lift the statute of limitations. "The laws didn't protect them when they were children and didn't allow them to come forward as grown-ups. It's just wrong," end quote. There still remains an opportunity this legislative session to pass a leadership or appropriations bill. Senator Tim Krayenbrink and Representative Ann Mayer, both Republicans from Fort Dodge, said they are working with leadership and in both chambers to craft a bill focused specifically on allowing survivors of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts of America to take full advantage of the bankruptcy proceedings. Meyer said she anticipated including language similar to the Alabama legislation in the standings bill, quote, "If we can get good, tight language around it, it's very disturbing. The whole story is," Meyer said. "I mean, this is top-tier abuse," end quote. Quote, "I think my goal for this situation is to make the legislation very narrow and very tight and confronting this particular situation," end quote, said Krayenbrink. Quote, "I feel that we now have the ball rolling," end quote. He said, quote, "We have leadership aware of it. We've got the governor's office aware of it. And you know, if there's something that we will do and we can do, then I will do everything I can to make them, to make it come to fruition," end quote. The next story is titled Sioux City Social Security Investigation is Requested by Caleb McCullough. Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and Representative Randy Feenstra are asking the Social Security Administration to investigate the Sioux City field office after receiving a tip about long delays in claims processing at the office. Ernst and Feenstra, both Republicans, sent a letter to SSA Inspector General Gail Ennis asking the agency to review complaints at the field office in Sioux City. In the letter provided by Ernst's office, Ernst and Feenstra said the field office's response to routine requests often takes, quote, weeks to months, end quote, and the office is, quote, dismissive or provides no substantive updates, end quote, when presented with concerns. The letter included an email that Ernst's office received from an organizational payee, an organization that manages Social Security payments with concerns about wait times on intake forms. The payee said in an email to manager at the office to a manager at the office that they had sent 12 intake forms to the office, some dating back to December 2023, and had not received responses on them. The Social Security Administration did not immediately respond to a request for comment. While Ernst did not provide any evidence that the delays were caused by remote work at the office, she tied the complaints to her long-running push for federal workers to return to the office. The letter pointed to the low number of workers in the agency's DC headquarters and said the field office delays are, quote, no surprise. And then there's a picture, and under it says, Senator Joni Ernst speaks during third annual Feenstra family picnic at the Dean Classic Car Museum in Sioux Center, Iowa on May 13th, 2023. And it's a picture of Joni, and she's by a microphone, and she's behind an American flag. Quote, Iowans deserve a Social Security Administration that actually works for them. I'm horrified by reports of the Sioux City field officer's habit of ignoring Iowans, and I'm fighting to get it to get to the bottom of it, end quote. Ernst said in the provided statement, quote, whether it's the UDSA, the VA, or the Social Security Administration, I want to see federal employees show up for taxpayers. Enough is enough, end quote. In a statement provided by Ernst's office, Feenstra echoed the remote work concerns and said the office should be doing more to get benefits to people on time. Quote, however, the SSA office in Sioux City has failed to uphold its responsibility to taxpayers with reports of serious delays and indifference to the needs and requests of Iowans, end quote. Feenstra said, quote, it's my concern that these delays are due in large part to the increase of remote work within federal agencies, end quote. A June 2023 report on disability claim wait times in the agency pointed to telework during the pandemic as one of the several causes of increased wait times. Other factors included the agency hiring new staff and losing experienced staff and changes in policy and procedures. Last August, Ernst asked the Inspector General at the 24 major federal agencies to investigate their remote work practices. In a response to Ernst's August letter, Ennis said management for staff, including the loss of experienced workers, is contributing to the agency's challenges, she said. Some staff have left the agency to pursue jobs with a more flexible workload and remote work options. The SSA, quote, had challenges recruiting and retaining employees because its positions are complex and require more training compared to similar positions in private industry, end quote, Ennis wrote. Most workers at the SSA, including field office workers, are required to work in person at least 3 days per week, Ennis said in the letter. She said the agency is reviewing the impact of remote work on productivity. Ernst has previously raised concerns about remote work at federal offices. In December, she released a list showing that most of the major federal agencies were using less than 20% of their office space. The SSA, along with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, were using at least the least space at 7%. The next story is titled, Pope Delivers Prayer for Peace. And there's an image above it, under which it says, Pope Francis greeting the crowd after celebrating Easter Mass on Sunday in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican, V-A-T-I-C-A-N. And it's a picture of the Pope surrounded by a crowd of people, and he is waving to them. Francis skipped Good Friday procession but appears in good health. By Nicole Winfield. Rome. Pope Francis rallied from a winter-long bout of respiratory problems to lead some 60,000 people in Easter celebrations Sunday, making a strong appeal for a ceasefire in Gaza and a prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine. Francis presided over Easter Sunday Mass in a flower-decked St. Peter's Square and then delivered a heartfelt prayer for peace in his annual roundup of global crises. Gaza's people, including the small Christian community there, have been a source of constant concern for Francis and Easter in the Holy Land overall was a somber affair this year given the war. Quote, peace is never made with weapons, but without outstretched hands and open hearts. But with outstretched hands and open hearts, end quote. Francis said from the loggia overlooking the square to applause from the wind-swept crowd below. Francis appeared in good form despite having celebrated the 2.5-hour nighttime Easter vigil just hours before. The pontiff, who had part of the lung of one lung removed as a young man, had been battling respiratory problems all winter, and his full participation in Easter services was not entirely guaranteed, especially after he skipped the traditional Good Friday procession. But in a sign, the 87-year-old pontiff was feeling okay. He made several loops around the piazza in his Pope-mobile after mass greeting well-wishers. The Vatican said some 60,000 people attended the mass, with more packing the Via della Consolazione Boulevard leading to the piazza. At the start of the service, a gust of wind knocked over a large religious icon on the altar just a few feet from the Pope. Ushers quickly righted it. Easter Mass is one of the most important dates on the liturgical calendar, celebrating what the faithful believe was Jesus' resurrection after his crucifixion. The Mass precedes the Urbi et Orbi, the city and the world, blessing, at which the Pope traditionally offers a laundry list of the threats afflicting humanity. This year, Francis said his thoughts went particularly to people in Ukraine and Gaza and all those facing war, particularly the children who said had forgotten how to smile. That was a quote. Quote, in calling for respect for the principles of international law, I express my hope for a general exchange of all prisoners between Russia and Ukraine, all for the sake of all, end quote. He said he called for the prompt release of prisoners taken from Israel on October 7th and immediate ceasefire in Gaza and for humanitarian access to reach Palestinians. Quote, let us not allow the current hostilities to continue to have grave repercussions on the civil population by now at the limit of its endurance and above all on the children, end quote. He said in a speech that also touched on the plight of Haitians, the Rohingya, and victims of human trafficking. For the past few weeks, Francis has generally avoided delivering long speeches to avoid the strain on his breathing. He ditched his Palm Sunday homily last week and decided to stay home from the Good Friday procession at the Colosseum. The Vatican said the decision was made to, quote, conserve his health, end quote. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 1st, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Tyler Schroeder from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Now for the obituaries. First, we have Janice Dorner. Janice Dorner, age 94, passed away peacefully at Midlands Living Center March 28, 2024. She was born August 13, 1929, to August and Lorna Mansberger. Dorner in Omaha, Nebraska. Janice found joy in spending time with her beloved family, her faith in her church, and her love for animals. Her legacy of love and family will forever be cherished by all who knew her. In addition to her parents, she will be preceded in death by sisters Gloria, June Peck, and Mary Dorner, and brother James Dorner. Janice is survived by nieces, nephews, family, and friends. Graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery on Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. The family will direct memorials. Next, we have Jeer Ann, or Jake, Powers. Jeer Ann Jake Powers, age 62, of Council Bluffs, passed away on March 26, 2024, at Jeannie Edmonds Hospital after a long, courageous battle with cancer. Jake was born on September 4, 1961, in Council Bluffs to the late Jerry and Betty Ragor. She was a lifelong resident of Council Bluffs. Jake graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1979. She married Timothy Powers on September 14, 1984, and they had two daughters. They always had a few pets running around, and Jake had a special place in her heart for all of them. She worked at Risen Sun Clinic for 17 years before taking medical leave. Jake loved her job working at the front desk where everyone knew her. She was very active in the volunteer community. She held positions with Green Hills AEA Kiwanis Club, Council Bluffs Historical Society, Jeannie Edmonds Foundation, Volunteer Director of Red Cross, Jenny Edmondson Arthritis Foundation, and the Union Pacific Museum. She was there when they opened the doors for the Union Pacific Museum. Jake was a force to be reckoned with. Up until medically required, she was out doing what she loved to do, helping those around her and spending time with her family, friends, and pets. In addition to her parents, Jake was preceded in death by brother Tom Ragor and grandparents Carl and Bernice Ragor. She will be remembered by her husband of 39 and a half years, Tim Powers of Council Bluffs, daughters Beth, Kyle Detweiler Powers of Sydney, Iowa, and Julia Colin Williams of Council Bluffs, grandchildren Jackson Richard and Gabriella, brother Mike Sherry Ragor, sister Marcy Hamsa, fur babies Elmer and Fudd, many other nieces, nephews, cousins, friends, and other relatives. Visitation Tuesday, 4 to 6 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Wednesday, 10 a.m., also at the funeral home. Jake will be laid to rest in Flint Cemetery, Griswold, Iowa, Luncheon and Eagles Club, 1530 Avenue F. Following the burial, memorials are suggested to the Jenny Edmundson Foundation. Next, we have William or Bill Sage. William Bill Sage, age 90, passed away peacefully at Prairie Gate on March 26, 2024. He was born August 13, 1933, to the late Alexander and Gertrude Reumping. Sage in Omaha, Bill graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1952 and then proudly served his country in the United States Coast Guard. He retired from Werner Enterprises. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his wife, Winifred Sage, daughter Debbie Herrings, stepfather Wallace Lewis, stepsister Dorothy Eckhard. William is survived by his children, William, Linda, Sage, Susan, Jeff, Cruz, and Thomas Tracy Sage. Grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. with a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Holy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Monday, April 1st, 2024. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. at the Corpus Christi Queen of Apostles Catholic Church. Interment will be in St. Joseph Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to either Corpus Christi Parish or St. Albert Schools. Next is Mark Whitney. Mark Whitney of Council Bluffs passed away March 11, 2024 in Mountain Home, AR at the age of 71. He was born May 30, 1952 in Omaha, Nebraska, the son of Donald and Joanne Young Whitney. He worked in sales at U.S. West Direct. He was a happy member of the Duncan's Breakfast Club in Council Bluffs. Mark and Carrie met in 1987 and have been together ever since. Mark enjoyed investing and farming. He valued the time he had with his many nieces and nephews, giving advice and encouragement. Mark and Carrie enjoyed gardening, fishing, hunting, and being in the outdoors. Mark was preceded in death by his parents, sister, Pam Bogardus, brothers David and Brian Whitney. Mark is survived by wife Carrie, brother Giles, Debbie, sisters Susan, Bruce, Radford, and Marcia Steve Lampman, sister-in-law Ruby Whitney, brother-in-law Bob Yanders, as well as pets Tasha, Charlie, Ginger, and Chester. A family service is planned for the future. Please leave memorials to your favorite charity. Next is Jerry A. Woodward. Jerry A. Woodward, age 87, of Council Bluffs, passed away on March 27, 2024 at Methodist Hospital in Omaha, Nebraska. Jerry was born October 26, 1936 in Little Sioux, IA, to the late Clarence and Joy Butts Woodward. He graduated from Pisgah, Iowa High School in 1953. Jerry married Donna Mae McKeever on September 29, 1956. They were blessed with three daughters and a son. Jerry worked for the Union Pacific Railroad and then for Burlington Northern Railroad, where he was an engineer, retiring in 1998 after 30-plus years of service. He and Donna May loved to travel in their retirement years. Jerry loved playing cards and the board game Aggravation. In addition to his parents, Jerry was preceded in death by his wife, Donna Mae, in 2019, daughter Lisa Qualsett in 2021, son-in-law Dennis Gascoigne in 2022, his sister Beverly Culver in 2005. Jerry is survived by his son, Jeff Jeannie Woodward, daughters Susan Phil Lehman, Lori Steve Spate Gascione, six grandchildren, Ashley Shannon, Jake Jordan, Tyler Nicolette Carson, and Bailey, and great-granddaughter Annabelle. Funeral service Monday, 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment at Memorial Park Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 E. Pierce Street. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Monday at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the American Cancer Society. The next article is called Howlingly Good and has a picture taken by Tony Gutierrez, Associated Press. And under that picture, it says North Carolina State head coach Kevin Keats holds the South Regional Trophy following Sunday's NCAA Tournament Elite Eight game against Duke in Dallas. And it's a picture of the coach holding the trophy with all the players behind him and the whole crowd of people behind them. NC State reaches first Final Four since 1983 title run by Associated Press. Dallas, bruising big man DJ Burns Jr., plays with plenty of joy, skipping on and off the floor and interacting with North Carolina State fans that he often works into a frenzy with slick moves and a soft touch shot. Quote, I was raised in a happy environment, end quote, Burns says. Quote, I try to take that with me everywhere I go, end quote. Now he can take that to the desert for the Wolfpack's first Final Four in four decades. Burns scored a season-high 29 points on 13 of 19 shooting. DJ Horn had 20, and 11th seed NC State beat Atlantic Coast Conference rival Duke 76-64 in the South Region Final on Sunday. NC State is back on basketball's biggest stage for the first time since the late Jim Valvano was sprinting around the court looking for someone to hug after winning the 1983 national title with an upset over Houston and Phi Slamma Jamma. Quote, these guys are so special, end quote. Seventh-year coach Kevin Keats said, quote, nine elimination games or you go home, end quote. These Wolfpack 26-14 head to Glendale, Arizona, with the most losses ever for a Final Four team, but on a winning streak that began after losing their last four regular season games and 7 of 9. They had to win five games against past national champions in 5 days in the ACC tournament, including a win over Duke in the quarterfinal round, just to get into the 68-team NCAA tournament field. Now they will play 7'4" All-American Zach Eady and Purdue in the first national semifinal game before defending champion UConn takes on Alabama. Quote, I'll say it like I've been saying it the whole tournament. When I stop having fun with basketball, I'll stop playing, end quote, said Burns, who was voted the South Region's most outstanding player. Quote, there's just been a total switch in our commitment, Nobody's being late to things. Nobody's being a problem on the court. Everybody's come together, end quote. Fourth seed Duke, 27-9, which ousted top seed Houston in the Sweet 16 two nights earlier, missed out on its second Final Four in three seasons after leading by six at halftime and maintaining that margin with 16 and a half minutes left. But soon after, Keats was called for a technical foul with 8 minutes left. His team was well on its way to becoming the seventh double-digit seed to make the Final Four since the tournament expanded to 64 teams in 1985. Midwest Regional number 1 Purdue 72, number 2 Tennessee 66. By the time all that scraping and scratching and diving on the floor was over, it felt like a shame that both teams on both and both those players weren't moving onto the Final Four. Just don't expect Purdue to feel bad about it. Boilermakers big man Zach Eddy went for a career-high 40 points Sunday to muscle Purdue within two wins of the title for the first time since 1980 with a victory over Dalton Knecht and his never-say-quit Tennessee teammates. The 7'4" Eddy, a unanimous AP All-American, didn't even need a ladder to cut down the net after edging out Netched, another All-American who finished with 37 points. The game's top two players and their teams went back and forth all day. How close was it? Within 5 minutes left and the score tied at 58, both players had scored 31 points on 12 field goals. According to OptiStats, this was the first time opposing players scored more than half their squad's points in an NCAA tournament game. Quote, you're trying to take away 100%, you're trying to take away maybe 80% of what he's trying to accomplish, what he's trying to get accomplished, end quote. Purdue coach Matt Painter said of Connect, quote, but we don't take Zach for granted. He could have scored 50 tonight if he'd made his free throws, end quote. Eddie missed 8 of his 22 attempts from the foul line. One of those misses sparked the play of the game. After Tennessee grabbed the rebound and worked the ball down court, Eddie swatted away Knecht's layup as he drove to the basket while trailing by 5 with 33 seconds left. It was Eddie's only block of the day, and it put an end to Vols' desperate comeback hopes. Now, that was the men's Elite Eight, but moving on to the women's Elite Eight, undefeated South Carolina returning to Final Four. Gamecocks will play NC State in national semifinal by Associated Press. Albany, NY, Dawn Staley has South Carolina back in a familiar place, the Final Four. And she got there this time with an entirely new starting lineup. Tessa Johnson scored 15 points, and Camilla Cardoso added 12 to help the undefeated Gamecocks to a 70-58 win over Oregon State on Sunday in the Albany 1 regional final of the women's NCAA tournament. Quote, proud because we beat the odds, end quote. Stanley said, quote, odds said we shouldn't make it back to the Final Four. Proud of our team for them believing in themselves. We created a certain level of chemistry and culture, and they stuck with it, end quote. It's the second consecutive year the Gamecocks have made it to the national semifinals undefeated. South Carolina hopes for a different conclusion this time. The Gamecocks lost to Caitlin Clark and Iowa in the Final Four last year. Quote, we're different this year. I think we can do a lot of things. We can shoot from outside, drive, Raven Johnson said. We can play from the inside out. This team is just a young, feisty, fierce team that's hungry. We've got chips on our shoulder, end quote. The Gamecocks, who have made the Final Four in four straight years, will play NC State on Friday night in Cleveland. The Wolfpack beat Texas later Sunday in Portland, Oregon. Quote, each time we get an opportunity to cut down nets is a kind of special, end quote, Stanley said. Two more wins by South Carolina would make the Gamecocks the 10th school in to finish a season undefeated in the first and the first since UConn did in 2016. Top-seeded South Carolina 36-0, led by 4.5 and built up a 14-point lead before number 3 seed Oregon State 27-8 got within 62-53 with 3 minutes and 55 seconds left in the game. Tessa Johnson answered after a timeout with a 3-point play, scoring on a drive to restore the 7-point cushion. The Beavers then went cold from the field, missing their final 7 shots. South Carolina couldn't score either until Johnson made 2 free throws with 44.5 seconds left. The Gamecocks sealed the win from the free throw line. Portland 4, number 3, NC State 76, number 2, Texas 66. Azia James made a career-high 7 three-pointers and scored 27 points, and North Carolina State earned its first trip to the Final Four of the Women's NCAA Tournament since 1998, beating Texas in a game played with 3-point lines at different distances on opposite ends of the court. River Baldwin added 16 points for NC State, 31-6, which will face unbeaten South Carolina in the national semifinals of Cleveland on Saturday. The Gamecocks beat Oregon State in Albany, New York earlier Sunday. Madison Booker, one of the top freshmen in the country, along with Southern California's Juju Watkins, finished with 17 points to lead the Longhorns 33-5, who were vying for their first final score since 2003. Before the Portland 4 region final, Texas coach Vic Schaefer and NC State's Wes Moore conferred with officials about a visible difference between the 3-point lines. The NCAA acknowledged a discrepancy but said both coaches agreed to play on. 4 previous games in Portland were played without anyone saying anything publicly about the issue. The court will be corrected before Monday's Elite Eight game between USC and UConn, the NCAA said. No matter how far away the arc was, it didn't bother James, who finished 7 of 9 on threes. NC State led by 18 points in the final half, but Texas closed within 54-48 on Dayana Gaston's jumper late in the third quarter. James answered with a 3 to put the Wolfpack ahead by 9 heading into the final period. Booker's 3-point play moved Texas within 63-55. The Longhorn kept up their pressure with Taylor Jones' 3-point play to narrow the gap to 65-58 with 4 minutes and 41 seconds to go. Another 3 by James kept Texas at bay. Baldwin's jumper that made it 72-62 with a minute 50 left all but sealed it for the Wolfpack. With 28 seconds left, James walked into a timeout with her arms raised to elicit cheers from the fans behind the bench. This next story is about NASCAR and is titled Late Caution Proves Costly. Hamlin steals victory from Gibbs teammate Truex on short track. This story is written by Hank Kurz Jr. Richmond, VA, Denny Hamlin won the race off pit road with Joe Gibbs racing teammate Martin Truex Jr. after a caution with 2 laps to go and won in overtime at Richmond Raceway on Sunday night. Truex dominated the second half of the NASCAR Cup Series race and seemed poised to hold off challenges by Joey Logano and Hamlin for the final 2 laps when Kyle Larson got nudged from behind on the front straightaway and skidded into the infield, causing the caution. Hamlin's victory was his second this season, the fifth of his career at what he considers his home track, and the 53rd of his career, but it left Truex happy with several drivers, or it left Truex unhappy with several drivers involved. Quote, he jumped to restart, end quote, Truex said of Hamlin, who started the restart on the inside. And there's an image that says Denny Hamlin celebrates after winning Sunday's race. And it's a picture of him with his crew standing around him, and he's holding a belt over his head. The victory pulled the four Gibbs Toyota teams even with the four Chevrolet teams from Hellendrick Motorsports with three victories each throughout seven races. Larson, who won this race last year, barely beat Truex off pit road during green flags stops with 65 laps to go, but Truex quickly caught him and pulled away as he had many times earlier. Logano, who started the race 22nd in points with just one top 10 finish, worked his way into the lead pack in the second half, tried to run down Hamlin in the two-lap dash to the finish, and was second, followed by Larson and Truex. The race was delayed for about 30 minutes at the start because of rain, and the car circled the track for several laps, hoping to help dry it before the green flag flew. They also ran the opening 30 laps on treaded tires meant for wet conditions before switching to racing slicks. The competition caution after 30 laps was non-competitive, meaning the drivers left pit road in the same position they were running. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Non-Pirelli for April 1st, 2024. The Non-Pirelli can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Tyler Schroeder from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.